Blog Talk Radio.
Well, sir, the question is, do you love God? And if you love God, you obey Him. If you're not obeying Him, you don't love God. The question isn't whether God loves me. The question is whether you love God. If you love God, you obey Him. So Jesus said, those are the words of my Savior.
Welcome to a special edition of Refining Fire Radio. This is your host, John McGlone. Today I will be moderating a 90-minute debate between Kerrigan Skelly and Eric Dickerson on the subject of Does God Exist? The chat room will be closed today. At the end of the debate, we will have a 30-minute question and answer time with our listeners. I would encourage all of you to write down your questions for the debaters that you may call in at the end of the show. That call-in number is 914-338-1582. Please limit your questions to the topic of the debate. I will be announcing the time for our listeners to call in at the end of our program. Defending the affirmative position is Mr. Skelly. Kerrigan has a Bachelor of Arts degree in religious education for Louisiana College with a minor in religion. He has 6 years' experience as a youth pastor, associate pastor, and senior pastor. Kerrigan has been consistently involved in street evangelism since January 2004, personally leading evangelism teams all over the United States since January 2005. He has preached publicly in the open air over 1,000 times at over 50 universities, in many public venues including parks, subways, street corners, parades, sporting events, beaches, state fairs, festivals, and many other public places where people may congregate. Mr. Dickerson, defending the negative position, has a bachelor's degree in business administration, concentrating in both management and marketing from East Stroudsburg University in Pennsylvania. Eric is a member of the Northeast Pennsylvania Free Thought Society and Lehigh Valley Humanist Society. He runs a YouTube page with the username Isbo10. He has done much self-study over several years, including reading over 20 books on this topic. He's also watched hundreds of hours of videos from both the Christian side of the argument and the atheist side. This includes many debates. The parameters and rules of the debate are as follows. No vulgar language, as much as possible, no strawmanning the other debater's position, and absolutely no ad hominem attack. If I think that the rules are being violated, I will let the offender know, then the debate will continue. If a speaker's time expires, I will give them a few moments, then I will call out the words, "Sir, your time has expired," to let them know the same, at which point they will cease speaking. I would ask both parties to allow me to be as obscure to this venue as possible by following the agreed-upon rules for the debate. Mr. Skelly will begin with a 10-minute affirmative opening statement, followed by a 10-minute negative opening statement by Mr. Dickerson. Let us begin with today's debate. Mr. Skelly?
Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. All right. Thanks for tuning in to listen to this debate today. Whether you're a Christian or not, we appreciate the fact that you're willing to set aside some time and consider this most important issue. First, I want to state what this debate is not about. This debate is not about all the gods in the world or God in general, as if there were such a thing. I'm not debating whether or not the supposed gods of any of the other religions exist. I'm here to defend the Christian God, the God of the Bible. And this debate is about whether he exists or not. This debate is not about the moral character of professing Christians. Neither is it about the moral character of atheists. I submit to you that there have been many professing Christians who have done horrible things in the name of God. I'm not here to defend them or their actions. I'm here to defend Christian theism as a philosophical worldview. And the moral character or lack thereof of someone who holds to a certain philosophical system does not necessarily defeat the system that they hold to. I presume from watching the videos that my opponent has put up on YouTube that he'll bring up the Bible at some point in time and to try to point out supposed contradictions in it. This debate is not about whether the Bible has contradictions in it or not. Of course, I don't believe it does, but he claims that it does. Yet behind both of our convictions about the Bible is a commitment to a certain worldview. I am committed to Christian supernaturalism, and he is committed to naturalistic atheism. And this is what fuels our views about the Bible. Lastly, this debate is not about who has the most, quote-unquote, evidence. Let's be honest here. We all have the same objective, empirical evidence when it comes to science, etc. This is true whether we want to believe it or not. The issue is not who has the most evidence, but what set of eyeglasses do people view the evidence through? It's how the evidence is viewed by the individual or what worldview the evidence is filtered through that really matters. And that brings me to what this debate is actually about. You see, we all have a philosophical worldview. Our worldview is made up of a set of assumptions or presuppositions about the world, which dictate how we view the world and the evidence that we find in it. I have found this to be true every time that I've talked to an agnostic, atheist, or skeptic about these issues. They usually ask for evidence, and I have given them evidence many times. Take, for example, the evidence about the validity of the Bible. I have shown atheists the validity of the Bible through prophecy, archaeology, science, manuscript evidence, and history. And sometimes evidence is overwhelmingly on the side of Christian supernaturalism and couldn't possibly be explained from the point of their point of view, which is atheistic naturalism. Yet they still won't budge. Why? Because they're committed to their underlying presupposition of atheistic naturalism. And this commitment to atheistic naturalism won't allow them to accept the supernatural or miraculous no matter what. They must first give up their worldview or presuppositions in order to see the truth of the evidence that I present to them. So what evidence will they accept then, if any at all? And in hundreds of hours of studying, listening to debates, and watching debates on atheism and Christianity, I've heard many atheists ask this question. They're asked, what evidence would convince you that God does exist? To which they usually reply, if I saw some fantastic miracle, like this building being lifted off the ground for several minutes, then I would believe in a God. But you know what? I don't believe them. They may say that they would believe in a God if such a thing happened, and in saying such, they might fool the listeners into believing that they are neutral or open-minded when it comes to evidence, but they don't really mean it. Just like the other supernatural evidence has been given to them, they would eventually dismiss this evidence as well. They would find some naturalistic way to explain how such a thing happened, even if they couldn't do so immediately. Or they may say something like, just because I don't have the answers right now, concerning the building being levitated off the ground, doesn't mean that there are no answers concerning it. And if I, as a Christian, were to say that the God of the Bible levitated the building off the ground, they would probably accuse me of employing a God of the gaps argument. And why do they mock Christianity as a God of the gaps religion? Well, it's very simple. They are committed to the naturalistic atheism as a philosophical worldview and aren't willing to budge. Just like I said, as my argument today is going to be philosophical by nature and not empirical. I will touch on two things, two philosophical issues in my argument, the principle of induction and the existence of a standard of morality. Let's start with the principle of induction. The principle of induction, to put it shortly, is that reality, as we know it, is uniform or law-like. This is something that we all assume in life. When we learn things in life, we turn particular instances of learning into general rules or laws that we apply to every area of life. That is, the way things happen in particular instances or experiences are viewed as the way things actually are in general. This assumption of uniformity leads us to taking our past and present experiences and predicting what our future experiences will be in similar circumstances. And we are all familiar with this. Let me give you a basic example. Let's say I have to get in the middle of the night to use the bathroom. I'm half asleep, and when I turn a light on, I can't see very well because my eyes haven't adjusted yet. So on the way to the bathroom, I stub my toe on something. Now, what's the first thing I'm going to think after I've stubbed my toe besides, ouch? The first thing I would think is, I never want to do that again. And the fact is, that's the first thing everyone else would think as well. In fact, if my toe didn't hurt the next time that I stubbed it in the same manner, I would assume that something was wrong with my toe, and so would everyone else. But after stubbing my toe, I would take precautions to ensure that it wouldn't happen again. But if I were a consistent atheist, I would have no reason to even think that the next time I stubbed my toe, that would hurt at all. Why is that? Well, because as an atheist, I would have no reason whatsoever to assume that nature is uniform in any way. I would also have no reason to assume that my past or present experiences have any value when it comes to predicting my future experiences that have similar circumstances. That is to say, atheists have no reason to assume what we all assume, that the principle of induction is true. The principle of induction or the uniformity of nature is not something that is proved through empiricism either. It's not something we can see with our eyes or that we can put under a microscope. It's the uniformity of nature is not something that's been proven scientifically or proven to exist through our five senses. The consistent atheist must say that it doesn't exist. The problem with denying the principle of induction or the uniformity of nature is that empiricism itself is based upon them. Because without the uniformity of nature, engaging in empirical observations or studies would be absolutely worthless. Yet all scientists, whether theistic or atheistic, engage in empiricism precisely because they believe that nature is uniform or law-like. In fact, that is exactly what scientists are looking for when they test, observe, and reproduce experiments. That is what all science is based upon. When discussing this issue of toe stubbing with an atheist, they will say something like, well, my toe has hurt every time I've stubbed it in the past, so I have every reason to believe that it'll hurt in the future when I stub it. But that's called begging the question. When an atheist or anyone says such a thing, they are assuming the principle of induction or uniformity of nature in order to prove it. And we all know that is circular reasoning. And even if the atheist's toe does hurt every time he stubbed it, all he could know is that his toe hurt every time that he has stubbed his toe in the past. He couldn't make a universal law that says anyone who stubs their toe in similar circumstances or in a similar fashion is going to hurt their toe. He couldn't even say that it's probable that his toe is going to hurt or that toe stubbing will hurt for anyone in the future, since probability once again assumes the principle of induction. So if the atheist is consistent with his worldview, there's no uniformity of nature or principle of induction. Furthermore, there's also no empiricism or science. What it all boils down to is this. For the atheist to believe in such things, he must borrow from my worldview as a Christian. And he does this in order to supposedly support his worldview and come against mine. This philosophical stealing just doesn't hold up under scrutiny. Atheism simply cannot account for the principle of induction, let alone anything that's abstract, immaterial, universal, and absolute. Now let's quickly look at my argument for the atheist not being able to account for an absolute standard of morality. Just like the principle of induction, an absolute standard of morality is something that is abstract, immaterial, and universal. The concept of an absolute standard of right and wrong, therefore, doesn't exist in a naturalistic atheistic universe where everything is just matter in motion. For the atheist to say that God is evil for any reason is to beg the question, where are the atheists getting their absolute standard of right and wrong from in order to bring any charge against the God of the Bible? That is, if they are saying God is wrong in an absolute sense. If they aren't saying that God is wrong in an absolute sense, then all they are offering up is their autonomous, arbitrary opinion. In other words, they're basically saying, I don't like God. Well, so what? Does it really matter whether atheists like God or not? Do atheists really think that saying I don't like God makes him go away? Or that saying I don't like God is a valid philosophical argument against the Christian position? Now, if the atheist does think that his charge against God is an absolute one, once again, where does he get his absolute standard of right and wrong from? In order to say anything is wrong or right in an absolute sense, you must have an absolute standard which to judge. In order to have an absolute standard of right and wrong, you must have an absolute standard giver. And that's just it. The atheists don't have that. They reject God altogether. And in doing so, they reject the only grounds upon which they could ever say that anything is absolutely right or wrong. Yet after rejecting God, and therefore any hope of an absolute standard of morality, they try to bring charges against God. How fallacious is this? If the atheists were to say that society determines what is absolutely right or wrong, then how could any society ever be wrong? Also, doesn't saying that society determines right and wrong bring us to a might equals right kind of society that we saw with Hitler? What happens when two societies disagree? Which society is right? Some atheists say that morality is based upon the greatest happiness of the majority of the people. But this makes happiness the greatest value in the world. Where do they get this value system from, and who says the happiness of the minority isn't more important? Atheists simply cannot answer these tough philosophical questions if they're consistent with their worldview.
Thank you, Mr. Skelly. Mr. Dickerson, your response, please. Mr. Dickerson?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I
can. Okay. Now, to start off,
I
just want to define atheism for the audience to understand it. Atheism is a deity or God, nothing more, nothing less. It does not say a deity does not absolutely exist. It just says there's no good reason to believe a deity exists. From here, we must establish the burden of proof. The burden of proof lies in the positive claim. So in order for an atheist to be right on the subject of God, all that needs to be known is that the atheist has not been given sufficient evidence to believe said God exists. When you look at it, there are two possibilities. God exists or he does not. The first is a positive assertion. The second we will call the null hypothesis. Now, as far as the Christian goes, they're going to have to demonstrate their God. And once they establish this, if the person making the claim that God exists fails to show this, it is reasonable to believe that God does not exist. Or to go back to the null hypothesis and say that God does not exist. We do this all the time with such claims as fairies, unicorns, or leprechauns existing. We clearly cannot prove that they certainly do not exist, but we all know we reasonably can go along our lives making the statement they do not exist. This is the same with God. So my opponent will have to demonstrate that his God has sufficient evidence for existence. To follow through on this a little further, I rather suspect that if Kerrigan was told by a friend that a dead man walked around his house last night, then he would just not up and believe it. He would demand more evidence, and until we receive this, he would see no reason to believe this. This brings me to another point. This idea that Kerrigan actually would not believe a friend on this, but believes a 2,000-year-old book written in an undereducated part of the desert that a man got up and walked out of his grave. Not only that, but Kerrigan actually believes said man was born of a virgin rather than his mother could very well have just been dying to avoid the harsh punishment for adultery at said time. But I digress. Back to the crucifixion. It is also a problem for Christians as their God is supposed to be perfect. This is confusing as one knows that forgiveness should not require a crucifixion. That in any other context does not sound like a perfect forgiveness. We are forced to special plead for this God that is perfect for him. This belief is then as irrational as it goes against every one of our previous understandings of what perfect forgiveness would be elsewhere. Not only does this perfect God sacrifice his son, but according to logic, this perfect God must sit and watch as children starve, children get raped or tortured, as natural disasters indiscriminately take out thousands or even hundreds of thousands of people, not caring what religion they are. This God sits and watches as soldiers blow babies' heads off in front of their mothers. Does this make sense for a supposedly all-powerful creator God who loves us to do so? Not to me. My opponent will sit there and use excuses like God's plan, Satan, or free will, so his perfect God couldn't create a perfect man that doesn't include child rape. Don't get me started on Satan. If Kerrigan is intellectually honest, he will admit that the Satan character in the Bible is responsible for far less atrocities than Yahweh. For instance, Yahweh kills millions throughout the Bible. Satan kills Job's kids and possibly servants after asking Yahweh permission, for which Yahweh apparently thinks it's a great way to test Job. Now, what happened here? Did God not care for these children? I don't know what's going on with that. And I've gone to use logic, which my opponent will now go and claim I can't use since I have no source for logic. This will be ridiculous. As we know, logic works, and just because we don't have a source for it doesn't mean we can't use it. Primitive and man didn't know why, but you can bet they knew enough to throw something at an apple in a tree and it would fall. They use gravity without a source for it. My opponent may even go on to assert there is no way for logic to exist without God. This is all that is an assertion. He will offer zero explanation for why it can't be. Allah, logic, fairies, Mithra, the invisible pink unicorn, the flying spaghetti monster have always been this way, or be a byproduct of the way this particular universe came to be from other natural causes such as multiverses. See, he will once again be using a cleverly disguised God of the Gaps argument, stating, I don't know where logic came from, so it must be his God. Worse yet for Carrion, his argument he may use is calling a God who made these logical and possible statements in the Bible. He basically states that where did the devil take Jesus first? He either took him first to the parapet of the temple, then to the high place to view all the kingdoms of the world, or he took to the high place to view the kingdoms, then to the parapet of the temple. Which did he take it to first? They're logically inconsistent. And that's from Matthew 4, 5 through 8, and Luke 4, 5 through 9. Here's Mark 16, 2, it was sunrise when the two women went to the sepulchre. John 21, it was still dark before sunrise when Mary Magdalene went alone to the sepulchre. That's another contradiction. They can't both be right. So logically, it's not living up to the law of non-contradiction. Okay. He also may state that I assume logic and we can't observe it. Let me define logic in here and see if this is true. Logic, a science that deals with the principles and criteria of validity of inference and demonstration, the science of formal principles of reasoning. See, logic is a way we have observed certain laws of the universe work. We can't observe the way things work and label it logic, or we have observed the way things work and we labeled it logic. So interesting that we can't observe logic when that is the basis for labeling something logic, is that we are labeling our observation of how the universe works as logic. My opponent may also try to claim morals and need to come from his God, but that seems odd considering the majority of us know genocide, beating slaves, telling women they shouldn't speak out, infanticide, ripping up pregnant women with a sword, and much more immoral, but yet they are contained in the Bible. And if you want, later on I can provide some quotes for that. Now, morals, actually, he straw-manned me here, so I'll go on to actually explain where morals come from. Morals come from actual benefit to society's survival. Now, as we learn about what benefits society's survival, our morals change because our evidence for what's the best for society is changing. This explains why morals have changed over the times of the years, and societies, when they've came together, have advanced further in morals than what they were in the past. Okay, so I will ask my opponent to stop simply pleading his God as the only explanation for these things and clearly prove his God is a cause, or there is no reason whatsoever to believe his assertions over any of the other options. The same will go if he decides to use Kadam's cosmological argument, which basically tries to go from the universe needs a cause to God is the only cause. These type of assertions want to create a false dichotomy. They want there to be only two options. One, God did it, or these things came from nothing. The true dichotomy we can use is God did it, or he did not. And then he did not do it can include many different options. The thing we are looking for is the odds. The odds that a particular Christian God did it over the almost infinite number of other possible gods, as well as other almost infinite number of possible natural not-God explanations, make it so unlikely that said God is near the impossible. He needs to show more than this type of assertion to prove his God. He needs to actually show why his God is the best explanation for any of these things. Kerrigan and other theists who use these types of arguments sound like someone who enters a room and sees a box in the room. They have never seen the box, and it doesn't have a clue, and don't have a clue in what is in it. Kerrigan will assert a pair of size 9.5 green Nike sneakers are in the box. If I walk into the room and don't automatically believe that those shoes are in the box based on their word, they tell me I'm irrational and think nothing is in the box. This is clearly a straw man of my position. I just refuse to believe his assertion of what is in the box if I know he hasn't seen what's in the box. This is ridiculous, as a number of different things could be in said box, and yes, nothing is a possible answer, but it doesn't mean I believe that there is absolutely nothing in the box. Now, we see how these assertions have worked in the past. When man didn't know how the sun came up, it was a god pulling a fiery chariot. Gods explain the ocean tides. They explain the stars and the moon. We now have better explanations. The God did an explanation has failed every time to be proven, and it's been proven many times, and it's been disproven many times over. It's like counting on a baseball player who has never gotten a hit in his career to all of a sudden come through in the bottom of the ninth of the World Series. It doesn't feel like a safe bet to me. Okay, so I just wanted to get a couple of the arguments out of the way that my opponent tried to bully his way through when he challenged me to call before. Instead of having a fair discussion, he actually muted me before and used different tactics to avoid the actual conversation. He has not actually answered some of my questions, apparently not knowing the fact that there's 38,000 Christian denominations exist, and each one interprets the Bible differently. So when he screamed straw man argument, remember, he wasn't intellectually honest enough to answer simple questions, so I have to go with the general biblical God here. And if I'm correct, I think my time's up here, so.
You have a few more seconds. That's fine, Mr. Dickerson. Okay, now we're going to have a 7-minute rebuttal from each party on the other's position, starting with Mr. Dickerson. Mr. Dickerson, go ahead, please.
Okay, so Kerrigan actually strawed me on several of my positions earlier in his initial statement. He was talking about me not being able to know whether I'd feel pain if I stubbed my toe. That is incorrect. I know that inductive reasoning exists. As I said earlier, I do not need to know where that actually came from. It's better to say I don't know than just to assert said God is the reason for this. He has done nothing to actually demonstrate that his God is the reason for any type of reasoning, any type of this cause. He's just saying, because he's got an exact answer, his explanation is better than mine. I say I don't know. I'm open to all different possibilities on that. Until he actually demonstrates this, I'm going to say that there's so many possibilities. Pinky the Invisible Pink Unicorn could explain this to me. He's asserting his God, and he wants to simply eliminate all other God possibilities from this conversation and create a false dichotomy for this debate, where I'm just, as an atheist, exploring all the possibilities that are presented throughout the world, and from there, trying to figure out which one's the right one. Until somebody actually demonstrates a cause of logic, there's no reason to believe it came from any one of these gods. And beyond that, God actually requires logic to exist. Existence itself is a logical dichotomy. Let's look at this. In order to exist, the dichotomy of existence versus non-existence must be there. Therefore, logic exists in order for God to exist, and that's you're going to say God does something other than exist. That is a dichotomy, and therefore, since dichotomies are part of logic, then logic already exists beyond God. So God is dependent on logic, so the best he can say with his worldview is that God came about at the same time logic did. If God is eternal, then logic is eternal independent of God as well. That's just simple logic using dichotomies there. He's also stated morality. I am going to actually now go through and utilize some wonderful Bible quotes to demonstrate why morality wouldn't come from an immoral being. Because we would expect a being that caused our morality to show morality. But no, we look here at Hosea 13:16. Samaria shall become desolate, for she hath rebelled against her God. They shall fall by the sword, their infants shall be dashed in pieces, and their women with children shall be ripped up. Since when is ripping up pregnant women with swords moral? Okay. Since when is a man beats his male or female slave with a rod and the slave dies as a direct result, he must be punished. But he is not to be punished if the slave gets up after a day or two, since the slave is his property. From Exodus chapter 21, I'm wondering here, since when is beating slaves moral? Yes, when 2,000 years ago, people from an undereducated part of the world who didn't have their morals in order wrote a book, it may have been considered moral. But this does not apply to a perfect moral God. His morals should already be up beyond that standard at this point. But no, we've got this in his inspired word. We have also got, from just to show that it's not just Old Testament here, we've got
Eric, I've lost your transmission. I'm going to stop the stopwatch and ask that you call back in. Eric, are you there?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I can hear you better now. I've stopped the watch when we lost your transmission. Are you ready to continue?
I don't know where exactly the transmission was lost, but I'll continue.
Okay, you have a little bit over 2 minutes left, sir.
Okay. So what I was saying is, to show I'm not just going all Old Testament, we have 1 Timothy 2, let the women learn in silence with all subjection. But I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. I wonder, when was sexism considered the utmost of morals? This is God's inspired word we're talking. And this is absolute morals, because sexism, we have learned over time, it's not beneficial to society. And when we go back to what's beneficial to society as our source of morals, it makes sense that we learned this. But when we go to an all-powerful God who is supposed to be perfectly moral teaching us, this becomes somewhat dumbfounding to me to try to figure out why he would do this. It also says in Corinthians 14:34-35, that your woman keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience, as also saith the law. If they will learn anything, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is a shame for women to speak in church. The New Testament also contains verses about slavery. Titus 2:9, teach slaves to be subject to their masters in everything, to try to please them, not to talk back to them, and not to steal from them, not to show them they can fully trust, so that in every way they will make the teaching about God our Savior attractive. And by the way, if any of those quotes are out of context, an assertion of out of context will simply not do. It's actually going to have to be shown to be in context, but I think I've done a pretty good job of showing that this God is not actually logical.
Okay, Eric, you're breaking up on our transmission here. Can you, we'll have 15, can I get you to, are you there, Eric?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, how about 15 more seconds to finish up your statement, please?
Okay, my statement is complete there. Basically, he's shown his morals argument has failed because his God is not a source of morals, and his logical argument has failed because his God has contradictions in his own book, so he doesn't apparently seem to be a source of either. That's the end.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Dickerson. Mr. Skelly will have 7 minutes to refute Mr. Dickerson's negative. Mr. Skelly?
Yes. First question I'd like to ask Eric, this is rhetorically, I have to answer right now, but does he have someone helping him in the background? I thought I heard someone else speaking to him, and he's kind of whispering to him. It seems kind of dishonest if he's doing that. Then he said, I strawman his position. I'd like to know what position of his I strawman. I was talking about atheism in general. I wasn't specifically talking about any position he had, and I wouldn't even know that until we got into the debate. Then he said, was I intellectually dishonest when he asked me questions prior to the debate about my God? Well, as I told him in email, I'll say it again. Do your studying, Eric. I have over 400 videos on YouTube. It tells all about what I believe about God. And I'm not going to support your intellectual laziness by telling you everything I believe before the debate starts. The God of the Bible exists, and that's what we're here to debate. And my assertion is about the existence of God, you can't have the principle of induction, and you can't have an absolute standard of morality. Now, he said that the absolute standard of morality is what benefits society most. Well, where does it get this value system where the beneficiary of society is the most important thing? Where does he get that from? Where does he get his absolute? What was the absolute standard giver that gave him this absolute standard of what benefits society is most important? Who says that? And who decides what is more beneficial to society than other things? So he's begged the question once again of where does he get his standard of morality from? And then he goes on. He gives a long rant here about the Bible and about things that happen in the Bible and how they disgust him. And he's done exactly what I thought he would do in my opening statement. I said, he's basically given us a biographical statement that he does not like the God of the Bible and the way he acts. And he assumes that he can judge the God of the Bible. So he says that his standard morality is what benefits society the best. Well, who says that what God was doing was not benefiting society the best? So from his own standard, he has to answer that. But to bring a charge against God, and say God was wrong in this, God was wrong in that, once again assumes an absolute standard of morality, which he has no right to even believe in. He's offered no standard of absolute morality. He's just given us his opinion of what morality is. What if someone comes along who's in society, and their opinion is that rape is beneficial to society, or that killing children is beneficial to society, and maybe the majority say that? What is he going to do then? He's going to have nothing to say. He said rape and torture is wrong. Soldiers blowing off babies' head is wrong, which I agree rape and torture is wrong. I agree soldiers blowing off babies' heads are wrong. But then he says that God, because God does nothing about it, God is wrong. Well, where is he getting the standard from? Once again, who says that God is wrong by doing nothing, by allowing man to have free will? And what standard is he using to say that these things are wrong? When it breaks down to atheism, has no right to believe in some kind of immaterial, abstract, universal laws. And he is saying, morality is abstract. It's not something you can touch or smell or taste. It's immaterial. He's claiming it's universal and absolute, but then he said that it evolves. Well, if it's absolute, it couldn't possibly evolve. That's the opposite of absolute. Absolute means it's true for all people of all times, whether no one believes it or not. He said that God created a perfect man who can always choose the right thing. Well, that's exactly what God has done. God has created a perfect man who can always choose the right thing. The problem is man hath chosen not to do the right thing. He's also created a man who is given the free will capacity to choose right or wrong. Now, if God wants a genuine love relationship with his creation, he must give them free will. Otherwise, they're forced to choose him and forced to do right. And if someone's forced to do right, are they really doing right? No, they're just puppets in the hands of a supposed God. He says the Bible was written in an uneducated part of the desert, which is ignorant conjecture. I'd like to see him prove that. We just know that the principle of induction exists. We just know logic exists. By the way, logic is not one of the arguments I'm using today, Eric. So I'm using the argument of the principle of induction and using the argument of morality. But he said, we just know they exist. We use them, we just know they exist. Well, how is it like me to do the same thing with God? We just know God exists. That wouldn't be philosophically cogent. I wouldn't be honest. It wouldn't be a debate. And what we're looking for is your debate. How does he know the principle of induction exists? And he said, it exists because I know it does and because it works. That's begging the question. The principle of induction, once again, says that past experiences or present experiences, we superimpose it upon future experiences and say that it's going to happen the same way if something happens on the same manner. Take this toe stubbing example. If I stub my toe and it hurts, I'm assuming that it's going to hurt again in the future. Well, how do I know that? I know that because the God of the universe has created this world in an orderly fashion, with uniformity in nature. And from my worldview, the supernaturally Christian worldview, I believe in things that are immaterial, abstract, universal, and absolute. And Eric's worldview, as an atheist, a naturalistic atheist, where everything is just matter in motion, he has no right to believe in immaterial, abstract, universal laws. But yet he does. And in doing so, he borrows from my worldview once again. So for him to say, I just know the principle of induction exists, I mean, how would you feel if he did that about God? That's my whole argument. How does he know morality exists? And if we're just higher forms of animals, like atheism and evolution supposes, then why should we have morality? Why shouldn't cannibalism be okay? Why shouldn't rape be okay? You know, when a shark rapes another shark, we don't call it rape. It's forcible copulation, but it's not rape. When it comes to humans, we call it rape. When it comes to animals dying, animals don't have funerals for each other. But when we die, we have funerals for each other. That's called dignity in human experience. When an animal kills another animal, even if it's of the same species, like a lion killing a lion cub, they don't have a justice system where they rule over them and force them to go to jail for a period of time because of what they've done. But we do. And if we're just higher forms of animals, we have no reason to believe in morality, and we have no reason to believe in the principle of induction, because animals don't work that way either. But once again, Eric's worldview with naturalistic atheism cannot support abstract, immaterial, universal laws, which he does believe in. All of us believe in. All of us use it. All of us believe in morality. All of us believe in the principle of induction. But I submit to you that my worldview is the only one that provides a proper foundation for such things.
Thank you, Mr. Skelly. Now we will have a 5-minute cross-examination period from each party. Please keep your questions and your answers short and to the point, and Mr. Dickerson will begin by cross-examining Mr. Skelly.
Okay, Mr. Skelly, I was wondering, where in the Bible do you get that rape is worse than, let's say, working on the Sabbath?
That rape is worse than working on the Sabbath. Well, first of all, the Sabbath has been done away with in the New Testament. There's an Old Testament law given to the Jewish nation and Jewish people alone. Rape is a standard of morality that was around way before Moses was around. It was something that was written upon people's hearts, put in them by God himself, and God has given us all a conscience and written his moral law upon our hearts. Breaking the Sabbath is not a moral law for all people of all times. It's only for the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, under that covenant. It's not a sin for me to break the Sabbath. But for me to rape someone is sexually immoral. And it's not loving towards them. And the Bible says, love your neighbor as yourself.
Okay. Can you tell me what the Bible says is the punishment for rape? It's the only statement about the punishment for rape in the Bible.
Yeah, well, we're going back to the Old Testament law once again. Now, keep in mind, we're going through these Old Testament laws. These were given to the Jewish people alone, not given to all nations of all time or all people of all times, and they are governmental laws, just like America has governmental laws. And America is a democracy, a republic. The nation of Israel was a theocracy ruled directly by God, so God gave them directly what the laws they should rule by. So just like our nation has the death penalty for certain things, and it has changed over time. God gave the nation of Israel certain punishments for certain crimes. So in the nation of Israel, he gave them the punishment of death for certain things for a good reason. But that does not superimpose upon all people of all time. I'm not as Christian. If I find out someone commits adultery or rapes someone, it's not my job to take up stones and kill them. That's not what the Bible teaches.
Okay, so I would wonder, what's your take on Matthew 5:17-20?
Okay, let me get there real quick and read it.
I think it starts something like not a jot or tittle of the old.
Sure, Matthew 5:17-20 says, do not think I came to destroy the law of the prophets. I did not come to destroy but to fulfill. For surely I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means be passed away from the law till all is fulfilled. Yeah, so that's nothing's passing away from the law. Not one jot or tittle. And when he's talking about the law here, he's not talking about just the laws found in Deuteronomy. Look at verse 17, the law or the prophets. He's talking about his word. God's word, thus saith the Lord, will not pass away, It'll remain pure. In fact, this is one of the verses that Christians use as a basis of the inspiration of the Bible, that it will not become corrupted, and God will preserve it for all times and for all people.
Okay. Well, are you throwing away one of the commandments? Because is not the Sabbath one of the commandments in at least one of the two different versions of the commandments God writes in the Bible?
A lot of the commandments in the Old Testament were shadows of things that were to come. And especially in the ceremonial law and the sacrificial law, etc., they were shadows of he who was to come. And the actual last Sabbath, if you go to Hebrews, it talks about entering into his rest in Hebrews chapter 4. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. So the final Sabbath, the final rest, is resting in Jesus Christ and having rest with him for all eternity, spending all eternity with him. But a lot of the things in the Old Testament were shadows of things that were to come. And the New Testament is the fulfillment of a lot of the shadows of the Old Testament. This is basic Christian theology.
Okay, so is your God perfect? And if so, is the ordering of killing innocent children and pregnant women a perfect action?
Yes, my God is perfect. If he orders the killing of anyone, yes, it is a perfect action by him because he has the right to do so. I have no right to order the killings of anyone. God has given life. God can take away life. God can serve justice upon someone. But you seem to be assuming that when someone is killed or someone dies, that it's a punishment specifically from God. Well, I would just say this, that when someone dies, the death is only a bad thing when that person is going to go to hell. If that person, the Bible says that God delights in the death of the saints, but it's the death of the wicked that he does not delight in. So if someone dies as a non-sinner or as someone who's following Jesus Christ or the God of the Bible, it's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. I look forward to dying. It's not a bad thing for me to die. It's a bad thing only for sinners to die. But like I said, God can bring judgment upon sinners by ordering their death in the midst of their sin.
And the time for Mr. Derek Dickerson's cross-examination has expired. And now we will have a five-minute cross-examination of Mr. Dickerson by Mr. Skelly.
Okay, Eric, how do you know what you know?
How do I know that I know?
How do you know
not
what
that
you
I
know? How
through
do you
observation.
Know? Okay, so through your five senses.
Yes.
Through observing and empirically. Okay, how do you know your five senses are working properly?
I don't absolutely know, but as far as functionality, it's working for me. How does this prove God, I'm wondering? That's my...
Well, wait a minute now. You just said, I don't know for sure that they're working properly, but they've been working properly.
I don't know if they've been working functionally for me because I'm still alive as far as I know.
So how do you know they've been working functionally for you? Just because you're still alive?
Because I'm still alive.
Uh-huh.
I don't run into walls on a regular basis because I know to stop from walking into a wall.
Now, wait a minute,
so
Eric.
You
wouldn't know if you're running into walls or not because you have to assume your eyes are working properly in order to know that you're not running into walls or not. So you don't know for sure what you know because what you know is you know through your five senses, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and by assuming empiricism is working properly for you, are you saying that the principle of induction exists?
I'm saying as far as I know it exists, as far as functionality for my mind that I'm using right now, it exists, and I'll continue to go along this red herring argument for as long as you like, but I'd
not
really
a red herring
like to
argument,
get something
Eric.
To...
It's a, very found,
well,
it's a very foundational argument, Eric, because your system of worldview is empiricism. You believe in what you can see, touch, taste, smell, and hear. That's it. And you can't see, touch, taste, smell, or hear the principle of induction. You can't see, touch, can you? Can you see, touch, taste, smell, or hear the principle of induction?
No, but I'm wondering what this has to do with God,
so
other than you're just going to go ahead and assert it, even though I may
Eric,
say, well,
Eric,
it could
I'm
be
the one asking
the invisible.
Eric, I'm the one asking the question. It's my turn.
Okay,
if you don't... if you don't know, if all you know is what you know through your five senses, and you don't know that empiricism or your five senses are working properly through your five senses, how do you know what you know? How do you know what you know is really true?
Maybe I don't.
There you go. And that's the point I'm making here. You don't know what you know is true. You see, unless you're willing to have a worldview that actually includes immaterial abstract things, you couldn't know for sure these things are true, could you?
I can't know absolutely certain on anything. As far as it goes for functionality right now, it's fine. I can have multiple explanations for what these things are that I don't know which one's the actual correct one. Who put a box in the middle of the room? I don't know. But I could say Bob did it, you did it, Jim did it, my brother
did
it.
The question is,
it still doesn't explain anything to assert one of them.
How do you know the box is even there? That's the question. If you can't trust your five senses, how do you know the box is even there? Now, you went on to say, Eric, in your rebuttal and in some of your questions about morality and about God doing immoral things. How do you know, what standard are you using to say that God is immoral in anything he does?
The same standard you're using. You're not using this God who's out there committing genocide and rape because you know, or at least I would hope you know, that genocide, ordering the raping of children, ordering women to have their stomachs ripped open by swords is not moral. You and I both know that. So we're going from some other...
I asked the question, Eric. I asked you, where do you get the standard from? I get mine from the Bible. Where do you get yours from?
Best of available knowledge.
Best of available knowledge? You just said you couldn't know anything for sure.
How
can you know you're not... Then how can you know your standard of morality, which you're judging God by, is even right or not?
Not for sure can also mean 99.9%, which is
you know
best
that?
Of available knowledge.
How do you know it's 99.9%?
I don't know what it is, but
you don't know
we'll
what
continue
it,
this
right.
red herring for as long as this question
is not a red herring.
Not
this
proving
is the very
God
foundation. This is the very foundation of the issue here: philosophical worldview. Can you claim that God is absolutely wrong for doing certain things if you don't have an absolute standard of right and wrong?
I do have an absolute standard of right and wrong.
What is it?
When we study whether societies survive longer by allowing people to be genocidally murdered or not, there is actual data that can back that up and show, guess what? Societies that go around genocidally killing one another don't tend to last as long. That does not
gentlemen,
benefit society.
Gentlemen, the time has expired for the cross-examination period for Mr. Skelly. And now we're going to have thank you, Mr. Skelly, for that cross-examination. Now we will continue the debate with a 7-minute rebuttal from each party. Mr. Dickerson will begin with Mr. Kerrigan following, Mr. Skelly following Mr. Dickerson. Please go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Kerrigan has basically straw-manned me once again with his morality argument. I am not saying I'm angry with God. I am showing a direct contradiction of what we know is moral versus the source of the supposed moral he is claiming. It therefore follows that based on the law of non-contradiction that we know our source of morals would not be immoral, that this God is out. Simple. So his argument for morals, we may not know where morals actually come from at all. But when you've got a God who's running around condoning slavery, genocide, every which bit of immoral activity that makes Satan blush in the Bible by the activities Yahweh performs, and there's no way to say anything but God or Yahweh, about 2.5 million slaughtered. Satan, 10 at most in the Bible. But yet, strangely, some people don't read the Bible that way. I don't know how, when you read a book about somebody killing 2.5 million people in cruel, inhumane ways or ordering it that way, you don't see that maybe blaming the guy who had to ask permission to kill 10 people is probably not the most logical route to go. But all with that said, it's still, his argument is basically, you don't know, I say I do know. Since I have an assertion of who put the box in the middle of the room, I must be right, even if he has no real clue who put the box in the middle of the room and can't demonstrate who put the box in the middle of the room. I wouldn't know who's being more intellectually dishonest there if there's a box in the middle of the room nobody saw it before. Not the guy who just asserts Jim Bob Smith walked into the room and said, put the box down. It's all right to not know something like that. That is simple. So, as I said before, simple cavemen, and yes, they did exist, by the way, because the Earth has been proven to be longer than 6 to 10,000 years old for all you creationists out there. Let's see. If cavemen knew to throw a rock at an apple and it would fall, they understood the function of gravity, but they didn't have an explanation for it. They still could use it. Why? Because they used because they observed it. That is the way it is. His argument that we can't know anything is basically he can't know anything, so nobody knows anything. And my statement is, we don't know God exists. There's no reason that God exists. So he's helping to make my argument by saying, how can you know anything? Well, I don't know that God exists. I don't believe God exists because I have never seen any evidence for it. So what grounds does he have to believe God exists other than just asserting his God exists? In the inductive reasoning he is talking about is a label we put onto a concept we use. So when we use the concept and we labeled it that so we knew what to call it so that as far as communication purposes goes, we were clear on what we were talking about. It is just a part of the laws of the universe. It's the way the universe works in the universe that we at least, to the best of our knowledge, based on our observations, know exists. He's just trying to go in a very philosophical, we don't know anything type of argument and say we're assuming, when that assumption, even if I grant him that assumption, where's the evidence that God exists? There's still just an assertion that his God is the reason for that. I could say inductive reasoning fairies created it. That's not Yahweh. I can assert the same thing. He doesn't believe that inductive reasoning fairies exist. How can he have any explanation for this without believing inductive reasoning fairies exist? Do you see how ridiculous that argument really sounds? It is completely out there when you just throw an assertion in there, expect me to take the premise that the only reason this can possibly exist is your God. See, that's what I talked about in my opening statement, was him creating a false dichotomy of his God or no God or nothing created at all. It's basically nothing created at all or his God is the false dichotomy he wants to argue. We're not going to play that game here. There are almost an infinite number of other possibilities that he needs to demonstrate why his assertion, and that's all it is a mere assertion, is better than any of these other explanations. So until he does that, he's simply asserting that his ability to have inductive reasoning, or whatever he's calling it, is there because of his God instead of inductive reasoning fairies. Instead of Pinky the Invisible Pink Unicorn, instead of Allah, instead of Thor, instead of Mithra, instead of Horus. Horus was a great guy. He kind of sounded a lot like Jesus in a lot of ways. I don't know if you know that. Maybe you should look that up. So did a lot of other gods. But that is the point. He is clearly just using God of the Gap arguments that use false dichotomies and an assertion of his God. Until he actually starts to prove this, I don't see much more I really have to say.
So, Mr. Dickerson, you're willing to forfeit the next 45 seconds of your rebuttal?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Now we will have a 7-minute rebuttal from Mr. Skelly. Mr. Skelly, are you there?
I'm here.
Go ahead, sir.
I want everyone to notice something here. Exactly what I pointed out in my initial opening statement. Do you see Eric's pre-commitment to his atheistic naturalism and everything that he says? He says, I asked him, how do we know what is moral and what is not moral? He keeps going back to what is beneficial for society. But where does he get this value system from that what is beneficial to society is the highest good there is? And he keeps saying, oh, we all know that rape is wrong. We all know. I don't doubt that we all know rape is wrong. My question is this. How do we know that rape is wrong? From Eric's point of view, he couldn't possibly know that rape is wrong because morality itself, once again, is an immaterial, abstract, universal, and he's claiming it's absolute, too. I don't know how he's claiming that. It's absolute because he said it evolved over time. But morality is a universal, absolute, abstract, immaterial entity, and in his worldview, he said he knows what he knows through his five senses. Now, how does he know that morality exists through his five senses? How does he know the principle of induction exists through his five senses? Once again, if he says, well, because it works. Well, that begs the question. The principle of induction says that my past experience will happen in the future. That's what the principle of induction is. For him to say it works is to presuppose the principle of induction in the first place, called circular reasoning. How do we know what is moral and what isn't? How do we know the principle of induction exists? How? How do we know? From Eric's point of view, he can't know anything. He's right about that. He can't know anything. He even admitted it in his last statement. He doesn't know anything for sure. That's a very telling statement about his own worldview, that he knows nothing for sure. Everything's a guessing game for him. He doesn't even know if his five senses are working properly or if the empirical method works, and that's the basis of everything he supposedly knows. And yet he's going to use empiricism, use his five senses, use the principle of induction, use an absolute standard of morality in which to judge the God of the Bible. Does anyone see how fallacious that is? Yes, my worldview can account for absolute morality. My worldview can account for the principle of induction. My worldview can account for my five senses working properly. He might not like that. It doesn't really make a difference if he likes it or not. The fact is, my worldview can account for things. And by the way, I'm not here to argue about other religions. This debate is about the God of the Bible. I'm not here to argue about Mithras or Horus or pink fairies or pink unicorns or Thor. I'm here to argue about the God of the Bible. And by the way, even if those were, which they're not, valid options about the principle of induction and about morality, first of all, it's not what this debate is about. And second of all, he doesn't believe in those things either. So where is he still? Where is he going to get his foundation for these immaterial, abstract, universal laws? He said inductive reasoning fairies could exist. Well, do you believe that, Eric? If you like, we can debate that sometime as well, but it's not what this debate is about. In all honesty, Eric, your example about the box being in the middle of the room, it's not about how it got there, Eric. It's about whether you even know it exists or not. How do you, if your five senses, you can't trust them implicitly, absolutely, your five senses are working properly, then how do you know the box is even in the middle of the room in the first place? How do you know that? And like I said, he knows all things that he knows, supposedly, through experience or through his five senses. How does he know anything at all? He said he just knows it. It's okay to know something like that. Well, how would you like me to say that about God? He just exists. It's okay that he just exists. How would you like me to say that about all the questions you ask me? I don't know. It's just that way. That's not the way debate works. That's not philosophical, cogent reasoning. Like I said, we're here to debate whether the God of the Bible exists. Eric has a pre-commitment. No matter how much evidence I were given, no matter if I were to take all these supposed contradictions that he's brought up in the Bible and show him there's no contradiction whatsoever, he would not accept that the Bible is God's word. Why? Not because he finds supposed contradictions in it, because he has a pre-commitment to atheistic naturalism. The question becomes, once again, but going back to morality, if we're just higher forms of animals, as atheism and evolution assumes, that we evolved over a random process of millions of years, and we're here where we are now. As he said before, the Earth isn't 6,000 years old or 10,000 years old, as the Bible says. It's millions of years old. Why don't animals have a system of morality? Why don't they have a justice system? Why don't they have things like love? Why don't they have dignity, like funerals for their dead loved ones? I watched a video recently of two lions walking by a lion from their pride who died. They walked by, sniffed it, and walked away. They didn't bury it in the ground. They didn't have a funeral service for it. They didn't go after the animal that killed it and said, you're going to go to jail for this. That's not what happened, because we are not animals. We are individual human beings made in the image of God. God's put a sense of morality within us. He's written put a conscience within us and written his law upon our hearts. And that's why we're moral beings. So unless Eric can account for morality somehow. Now, listen once again. I'm not saying that atheists don't act moral, that atheists don't use logic, that atheists don't use the principle of induction or engage in empiricism or trust their five senses, or that they don't believe in morality. I'm simply saying they can't account for such things because their worldview, which is material in motion, is all it is. It's materialism. It's atheistic naturalism. The material world is all there is. How can they account for things that are outside of the material world? And the answer is they can't. And once again, I'm looking for an answer to this, Eric. Where do you get this value system from that what benefits society the most is the most important value there is? See, what Eric is doing, he has no absolute standard. He's made that standard up himself. And some people may think that's a good standard. Some people may think it's not a good standard. But the fact is, he's made up the standard. He has no standard giver who gave it to him. And by the way, Eric began to exist at some point in time. So he can't be the absolute standard giver himself. So all he's doing, once again, is being autonomous and arbitrary and offering his opinion. He's not offering any kind of absolute right or wrong, and he can't actually say God is right or wrong for what he has done or what he has done in the past or what he says. All he does is offer his opinion, his biographical information that he does not like God, and he thinks what God does is wrong, but he has no way of proving such a thing because he's being autonomous and arbitrary, and his worldview can't support such statements philosophically. That's it.
Okay, very well, Mr. Skelly. Thank you so much. Now we will have our final five-minute cross-examination period. Again, please keep your questions and answers short and succinct. We will begin with Mr. Dickerson and follow with Mr. Skelly. Mr. Dickerson?
Okay, simple yes or no question. Does God see everything?
God sees everything that can be seen.
Okay, so since we can assume that child rape is part of everything that can be seen, we can assume that you believe that it is perfect for God to sit and watch a child get raped when he, according to the Bible, is more than capable of coming down and stopping it. Is that correct?
Yes, God could stop a child from being raping, but from my point of view, from my worldview, he has good enough reason for allowing it to happen, not causing it to happen, but allowing it to happen.
To the best of your knowledge, what is that reason for allowing it to happen?
Oh, I don't presume to know God's reasoning on those issues.
So, would you grant a human being the same level of forgiveness on that if you found out your local cop had sat and watched a child get raped and did nothing about it? Would you think that cop had perfectly valid reasons to do it, or would you expect to have them?
That's a category error. You're comparing a human being to the God of the Bible, who's sovereign and infinite in wisdom and infinite in knowledge. God has every reason. He's infinite. He's above me in my wisdom and my knowledge. So for me to bring a judgment against him is, once again, to use the standard that God gives of knowledge and reason and logic and morality and bring it against him himself, begging the question.
So you believe God's help is at a higher standard than us, correct?
No, God's not at a higher standard than us. He is at a different standard than us because, for example, murder. If a human being killed another human being, it'd be murder. If God kills a human being, he has a right to do so because he is given life and he can take it away. And he can bring justice down upon people who have done wrong things. In regards to rape, God's at a different standard because he has infinite wisdom, like I said. So he knows more than I know.
Okay. Would this world be a better place with or without child rape?
This world would be a better place with or without child rape. That's
yes.
Your question?
Yes.
I think from a human perspective, of course it would.
it would be a better place without child rape, right?
And if it were up to God, if God were to force his hand, he would say the same thing.
So God, who in, was it Numbers, I think, agrees with Moses about taking the virgin children for their own, is against child rape?
What verse are you talking about now?
Let me pull it up here. I've got it on my paper here.
I can't respond to it, but I know exactly what it says.
Okay, let me pull Numbers up here. Now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman that hath known man by lying with him. But all the women children that have not known a man by lying with him, keep alive for yourselves. So this is a God who's...
Numbers where?
Numbers 31, 17, and 18.
Verse 15, and Moses said, have you kept all the women alive? Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the incident of Peor, and there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. Now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones, and kill every woman who has known a man intimately. But keep alive for yourselves all the young women who have not known a man intimately. So you're assuming that it's saying here that they're going to force these young women that are keeping alive to marry other men or to be raped by other men?
I think it's a pretty fair assumption, considering they felt the need to classify them by virgins or not, based on the laws of the land.
It doesn't say anything about rape there, so you're assuming that.
It says,
now, therefore, kill every male among the little ones, verse 17, and kill every woman who has known a man intimately, but keep alive for yourselves all the young girls who have not known a man intimately. It's talking about being united together with people from other religions, which is idolatry, which God strictly forbids them to do. And now he's saying if they haven't known a man, they haven't broken God's law. Where does it say anything about rape in there, Eric?
It's kind of implied, and when you read a verse about killing men and women, children, and then all of a sudden you're going to sit there and say, wait a minute, it's not women, it's not rape. It's killing, it's the killing kids part, all right. If you're going to, I'll take away the rape. Is killing kids
time,
morally correct?
Gentlemen, time, Mr. Dickerson, time's expired for your cross-examination. Now we'll have a cross-examination by Mr. Skelly of Mr. Dickerson. Mr. Skelly, please go ahead.
Eric, like we said before, you said you know all that you know, or you could possibly know, through your five senses, correct?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
To the best of your knowledge, okay.
Yes.
Is morality something you can experience through your five senses?
Morality is based on experiences with the five senses of harm to me, yes.
No, that's what I'm asking. That's you imposing your standard upon it. How can you know that morality itself, as a concept, exists through your five senses?
Communication with other people to get these experiences combined into where we have experiences actually coinciding with one another. But that comes through our senses again, which you're going to sit here and say is a circular reasoning, and yet we're still not getting any actual logical statement that leads from inductive reasoning exists, therefore God must exist without the premise of God is the only reason for inductive reasoning. So,
Eric, my
I'll be glad to go through this
God's
gaps argument all day.
Eric, my worldview is a supernaturalistic worldview. Your worldview is an atheistic naturalistic worldview. You can only know what you know through your five senses. Now, if you can't know anything, Eric, how can you possibly know that God is wrong for allowing these things to happen?
Because they don't benefit our society.
Where do you get this from? Where do you get this from that benefiting society is the highest value there is?
It's a actual part of survival of the fittest,
that is part of
evolution.
And why is survival of the fittest important?
Because for whatever reason that I can't explain, and I admit I can't explain it, But just because you assert it doesn't mean you've got the answer either. I want to survive. Okay?
Why do you want to survive? Why is survival important? Why is that a value?
As I said, I don't know. But then again, this is just turning into a God of the Gaps argument because I say I don't know. That means opens up your worldview for an assertion
I didn't ask you a question, Eric. I didn't ask you a question. I didn't ask you to go on your rant. I'm asking the questions now. What happens in a society where some people think one thing benefits society and other people think an exact opposite benefits society? Who's right and who's wrong?
The society that actually eventually presents the evidence that shows that this society moves on better than the other society as far as survival.
So survival, once again, is the most important thing.
Yes.
So survival is the most important thing, and what if survival is dependent upon raping and killing certain people? Would raping and killing certain people be valuable then and be moral?
I can't really think of a situation where necessarily raping and killing children would be necessarily moral, so my explanation doesn't explain at all. But still, it leaves questions, but based on questions, does not give anybody the right to assert.
Eric, an atheist said recently that I heard on a video, he said, if there was a society where there's only one woman and there's lots of men, now your position is survival is the most important. If that woman was refusing to have sex with other men, would it be a moral thing to do to rape her?
I don't know.
You don't know? You told me survival is the most important thing.
I say I don't know. I'd have to weigh that situation when it came.
Is survival the most important thing, Eric?
Survival is important to morality, but most important does not mean the only thing to morality.
Okay, so if survival is the most important thing, and there's only one woman left, and she refuses to have sex with other men, that's the only way we can survive as a race. Should those men rape her? Hello?
Probably not.
Oh, so you have someone in the background helping you?
No, I said I do have my brother here, but he's not really helping me. I said probably not. Now,
probably
I can rethink, probably not. So maybe my survival argument isn't the greatest, but it's still another explanation that still has less flaws than yours.
So where does morality come from then?
I don't know.
Yeah. You don't know anything, it seems like.
I don't know.
Time, gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Skelly. Now we've come to our final 8-minute closing arguments for this debate. I would ask that neither party introduce any new materials at this time, but to review what's been dialogued previously. Mr. Dickerson, will you please?
Okay. Final part of the argument is that just because I don't know where morals exist, I'm sure Mr. Skelly has looked up the definition of God of the Gaps argument. When your opponent doesn't know, and he did that, by the way, in the beginning, God of the Gaps. If your opponent doesn't know, you can't just simply assert. You still have to demonstrate. I have said that I think there's possibilities that it's just a part of the universe. I think it could just be even beyond the universe. I think it's possible that moral fairies or inductive reasoning fairies created it. Not likely, but somewhat possible. Any of the gods are possible, except for some self-contradictory god, such as an all-perfect, all-loving god who happens to watch children get raped, because based on all of my knowledge of this, that sort of contradicts the definition of perfection. So watching children get raped is not perfect, but I have had my opponent say it is, and he's trying to simply embarrass me by having me say I don't know. His arguments have basically made him say some of the most immoral things I can think of, that you think it's okay to watch children get raped, that you think it's okay, that it was perfect to kill children with a sword and rip children out of their mother's stomachs with a sword. He has stated this was perfect. I don't know where his morality actually came from to begin with, because this is not the morality our society has. So to sit here and claim that our morality society, or our society's morality, comes from this God is not the way it is. We all know these things are wrong, but this is what this God does. Now, you can have lowered expectations for your God. I know what my morals are. You know what your morals are. I can't believe he even said those things. But in order for his God to be the explanation, he is required to say that it is perfect to rip women's stomachs open with swords. It is perfect to watch children get raped. I cannot stress this enough, that this is what Mr. Skelly has said on his own radio show. That, to me, shows that the morality we're talking about isn't even on the same level to even be having this conversation about what the cause of morality is. We need to sit down and actually discuss what this morality is a little bit more before we can even assert what the cause of this morality is, if we can't even agree that it's wrong to watch children get raped. I don't know what to say to that. I don't know what to say to his inductive reasoning argument, because all he's done is thrown in, if you actually put his argument down into a logical argument for this, it states this. Inductive reasoning exists. God, Yahweh, or God of the Bible, is the only, or Jesus, whichever you want to call him, is the only explanation for this. Okay. Talk about a begging the question argument. Seriously. Because you're second premise, that's the hidden premise in your argument, is basically the conclusion you're looking for. You're asserting as your second premise that Yahweh is the only explanation for this without ever eliminating any other options. You have just said, because I have a reason for this that I know for sure, without any good reasons that you've given us, other than you have one, that you know why it exists, I don't know that it exists, or I have no reason for having inductive reasoning. Inductive reasoning could very well just be. You know, we all have used the function of inductive reasoning. It's worked for us. Maybe it doesn't really exist. Maybe we're living in some big video game simulation. Do I believe this? No. Do I believe it's definitely not true? Not a chance either. So what I believe is based on my best available evidence, which comes from the only sources of evidence I actually have, is my senses. That is the only source of evidence we have right now. So to believe anything beyond that just opens up an entire realm of possibilities where you have even less ground to stand on for your God, because then logically contradictory beings such as the invisible pink unicorn could really be responsible. That's the problem there, because the one thing I've found amusing is that whenever I've debated a Christian, not one has pointed out the contradiction of the invisible pink unicorn. Not once have they done this, that one thing cannot be invisible yet pink. Why is that? Because their God is just as contradictory. Loving yet watching child rape, that is the point. That is a huge contradiction with the problem of evil. Because you're telling me this God is loving, perfect, forgiving, yet he also will turn around, because the only way to heaven is through accepting Jesus. Now, what do we know about the Holocaust? That the victims were Jewish. What do we know about a majority of Jewish people? They never accept Jesus. Guess what happened? I'll tell you what happened. If Christianity is true and his morals are true, we must believe it was moral to send all the Holocaust victims to hell for eternity after already suffering. Now, his argument has been from our morals. So my argument is to counter that, that the being he's proposing is so immoral that there's no possible way it could possibly be the source of morals. That is the basis of the argument here. He has been forced to say immoral things that we know are moral. We may not have a reason for it, but I know Kerrigan over there knows this. So I would love to hear an explanation for this or hear a logical actual argument from him where he presents A and B means C, God. But so far we have got none of that. We've got assertions. So, with that said, I'm willing to sacrifice whatever time I have left to that Mr. Skelly actually try to present some sort of argument here.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dickerson. We'll bring in Mr. Skelly now for his final conclusive arguments, 8 minutes. Now, Mr. Skelly, would you like to begin?
Yes. I wonder why Eric keeps giving up time. Because he really has nothing else to say. Because like he said, he really doesn't know if he knows anything. He just thinks he may know something. There's a possibility he doesn't know anything. Like he's bringing up pink unicorns, fairy, etc. And he brings up a good point. Those things aren't material. Material things begin to exist at some point in time. So those things couldn't possibly be the foundation for the existence of immaterial, abstract, universal laws. But if he really believes in pink unicorns and fairies, we can debate that as well. But he doesn't believe those things. He believes in an atheistic, naturalistic worldview which simply cannot account for anything that's abstract, immaterial, universal, and absolute. He keeps going back to me saying that God was perfect, that these things were God's perfect will. Well, no, that's not true. I didn't say that. I said God had a reason for allowing these things to happen. And God does have a reason for allowing these things to happen. But if God's perfect will was always done, there'd never be rape. There'd never be murdering. There would never be sin, period. Now, is he ready to impute his own sin to God as well? That God's it's God's fault that he's sinning? Because he basically wants to impute all evil things that have ever happened as being God's fault. And he keeps going back to rape. Now, here's a question that Eric needs to answer for himself. Does Eric know that rape is happening somewhere around the world? If he does, which we all do know rape is happening somewhere around the world, is Eric himself doing everything he could possibly do to stop all of the rapists and all of the raping? Of course not. So according to his own reason, according to his own foundation, that because God isn't doing everything he could or he's not forcing people to stop sinning, whether it's rape or child molestation or murder or lying or stealing or lust or fornication, because God's not doing this, that he's actually at fault for these things happening. Of course not. It's not the way things work. It's like I'm not at fault for every evil that's happening in the world. He's not at fault for every evil that's happening in the world, even though we're not doing everything we can to stop this evil in the world. He said, this is an actual quote from him in his final statement, inductive reasoning could very well just be. Well, how would you like me to say that about God? God could very well just be. That wouldn't be reasonable. That wouldn't be philosophical. That wouldn't be logical. But that's what he's doing with inductive reasoning. And I'm simply telling you, he can't account for inductive reasoning. He can't account for morality. They very well could just be, but he can't account for them. And guess what? He's still using them. Now let's apply it to me. Let's just say I say the same thing either. God could very well just be. Well, what's wrong with that? He's doing the same thing. Do you see the hypocrisy here? The hypocrisy in him holding me to a higher standard and saying God exists that he holds himself to when he engages in things that he considers reality, like inductive reasoning, the principle of induction, uniformity of nature, his five senses working properly, empiricism being trustworthy, morality being absolute and universal. He's engaging these things, but he can't prove they exist. But yet he wants me to prove that God exists. I'm telling you that reality as we know it consists of inductive reasoning. It consists of morality, consists of logic, consists of using our five senses and trusting them, can only be accounted for if the God of the Bible exists. Once again, this is not about the God of other religions. It's not about pink fairies or unicorns. If he wants to debate those, go debate someone who believes in that. I don't believe in those things. But he doesn't believe in those either, so he still doesn't have a foundation for what he believes in. Eric Dickerson, I was made aware of a quote that he put on Facebook today. by someone who emailed me who I don't even know, who knows Eric on Facebook. This is the actual quote from him. Today at 4 p.m., I hand an evangelical preacher his ASS on a silver plate on his own radio show. Really? Well, I don't think that happened, Eric. As the Bible says, pride goes before the fall. Pride goes before the fall. But he also said, just because I don't know where morality comes from. Well, if you don't know where morality comes from, how can you bring any charge against anyone, let alone the God of the Bible? How can you say anyone is wrong or right in the absolute sense if you don't know where morality comes from? If you don't know where it comes from, how can you know it really is true? As we saw in the question and answer session a little bit ago, he doesn't even know if his standard of morality is even true, because he'll say that rape is always wrong, but then when I present him with an argument where rape must happen in order for his highest value, survival, to be true and to go forth, he says, well, I don't know. Well, of course he doesn't know, because I'm forcing him to be consistent with his own worldview of saying, well, survival is the most important thing. But he doesn't want to be consistent with that. At least I'll give an answer and say, well, yeah, God allowed it to happen, and he has some good reason for allowing it to happen. At least I'm being consistent. The all-perfect, all-knowing God could do such things as we find in the Bible. That's what he said. Well, where is he getting his standard of perfection from? See, he's taking his standard of God shouldn't allow this. God shouldn't allow that. God shouldn't stand by and let this happen. He's taking his standard of perfection and imposing it upon God. Where does he get his standard of perfection from? And like I said, who is he to bring a charge against God when he doesn't even have a workable foundation of morality to go from? He said, my statements have been immoral. Well, really? Says who? Says you? So because you say it's immoral, it is immoral? Well, what if I say everything you say is immoral? Does that make it immoral? Of course not. In my opinion, atheism is basically broken down to this. I don't like God. I don't want him to rule over me. I don't want him to exist. And I definitely don't want to be judged by him. And this is exactly what the Bible says in Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 22. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. See, the problem is not a matter of not having enough truth or enough evidence. It's clear that for Eric to even know what reality is, he must presuppose the God of the Bible. He must have a workable worldview, a supernaturalistic worldview, to even believe those things. He's suppressing the truth. Why? Because of unrighteousness. And just so you know, ladies and gentlemen, my arguments I've been given all along come straight from the Bible, Acts 17:28. For in him we live and move and have our being. Everything starts with God. In him we live and move and have our being. When it comes to logic, reason, morality, all these things begin with God. And that's why Psalm 14:1 says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Colossians 2, verses 3 and 4 say this, Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Now this I say, lest anyone want to deceive you with persuasive words. Colossians 2:8. Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the tradition of men, according to the basic principle of the world, and not according to Christ. The same thing that I said in my open statement is true of Mr. Dickerson. He doesn't like God. He doesn't want him to exist. He can't prove he doesn't exist, of course. And he's offered not one reasonable argument against what I have brought forth today, which is the transcendental argument from God, using transcendental necessities. If we're going to believe what that reality is what it is, we have to account for these things. An atheist, from their naturalistic, materialistic worldview of just matter and motion, all I believe is what I know through my five senses. They can't account for these things because they don't know these things exist through their five senses, even if their five senses are working properly. So I submit to you that atheism has failed. It's reduced to absurdity. Because they can't account for reality itself or knowing anything at all.
Thank you, Mr. Skelly. And Mr. Dickerson. That concludes our formal debate period for the show. We now have 27 minutes to take questions from our listening audience. That call-in number is 914-338-1582. When I pick up your line, please introduce yourself, where you're from, and direct your question to the appropriate speaker. Each debater will have up to 2 minutes to respond to each question asked. I would ask that the callers would not interrupt the responses from our speakers,
This is not a time for callers to debate the speakers on our show. Each caller will only be able to ask one question unless there are no more callers in the queue. And let us begin with our first caller. Caller 570, you're on the line.
Hello.
Hello. Go ahead and introduce yourself, please, sir.
I'm Bill from Pennsylvania. I got a question for Kerrigan. If you're saying
Joel
that
from Pennsylvania.
Eric cannot, Bill from Pennsylvania. You're saying that,
go ahead,
that Eric cannot assert that that logic exists. But where does God come from? Because I think you're going to assert this, that he just exists.
Okay,
so if I can understand the question properly, Joel, if I might just have a minute to clarify, you're saying that Kerrigan says that logic cannot exist, and so you're asking Kerrigan...
Where does God have a cause from? Because he's going to assert the same thing, so his problem is going to go back to the step further.
I'm sorry, Joel, you're breaking up quite a bit on the air. Can you slow down your question a little bit and try to speak into your phone, please?
Okay, he has a problem with Eric saying he doesn't know where logic and all that comes from. So then we have the problem of where did God come from? Because at the end of the day, he's just taking it a step back further. Because he can't say where God came from. He thinks going to assert he's eternal.
Yeah, I understand.
Okay,
the question,
okay, go ahead, Kevin, please.
Yeah, so the question is, if Eric can't say the logic exists, what, you know, why can I say that just God exists? Well, God is the uncaused cause. You're right about that, Joel. Or Joel, I can't remember what your name is. You're right about that. God has always existed, always will exist. He's the uncaused cause. But the problem is not whether he's just saying that logic just exists. The problem is Eric's worldview, where he knows only what he knows through his five senses, can't account for abstract, immaterial, universal laws, like logic, which I really didn't bring up very much. I brought up the principle of induction, and I brought up morality. And he can't know these things exist because his worldview, he even said what he knows what he knows through his five senses. And he can't even prove that that is true, that his five senses are working properly, by using his five senses. So I guess
okay,
Eric, now it's time to respond.
Yeah, Eric, you can have your 2 minutes to respond.
With that said, I think at some point we need to stop this straw man where I have no reason to believe any of these things. I've given many different explanations that I'm just looking for evidence for. There's explanations I don't have. So there's explanations I've already given that are possible explanations I could explore, your God being one of them. Now, just because I don't know which one it is doesn't mean I can't use it. Again, I go back to the guy who threw the rock at the apple. You sound like him asserting that magical fairies that are invisible bring the apple down when the rock hits the ground and saying, yeah, that guy has a better explanation than the guy who simply says he doesn't know why it hits the ground, but it just does. That is what Kerrigan's argument is in a nutshell.
Is that your final answer?
That is my final answer.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we have a caller from area code 310. Caller 310, please identify yourself and ask the question of the debater you'd like to ask.
This is Joel Jackson. I'm actually on one of Kerrigan's Facebook pages, one of his friends. I think that, like Kerrigan said, it boils down to Eric not wanting to believe his unrighteousness, because on a daily basis as a Christian, I pray for many people who are sick and are healed and instantly, and I would be more than willing to prove that. And I think that, you know, even if that something
sir,
like that happened to Eric, he would try to deny it. Hello?
Sir, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Do you have a specific question for our speakers, please?
Okay. Well, I think that why doesn't he do his research and try to confirm, like, any of the miracles that happen on, you know, in the Christian system, in the Christian religion, and try to, instead of trying to, you know, invalidate the claims, instead of doing and not doing research, like, why doesn't he do research on actual miracles happening to prove that there is a God and he exists?
Okay, sir, are you presuming he hasn't done that research?
Yes.
Okay, let's ask Eric and see if he has. Hang on just a second. Eric, go ahead.
Okay. I think your name was Joel, or what? I don't know what his name was. But I want him to just go onto Google, okay? Type in prayer study heart patients. No known. There was no benefit from prayer. If you're saying that prayer creates miracles, why doesn't it work in studies? There were three groups done in an 1,800-person study over about 20 years where the people who knew they were being prayed for actually fared worse. The reason they don't know, there's also prayer has failed. Go look up, 11-year-old girl dies because parents pray to God instead of taking to a doctor. That is the problem with prayer. It fails. Go look up the towns where they have a cemetery full of people dead because their parents prayed instead of took them to a doctor. These miracles,
Eric,
are not true.
Eric, I'm sorry to interrupt you, sir. I've stopped your clock. I wanted to give you a chance to actually answer his question, what I believe I understood his question to be, which is, have you researched the supernatural miracles and prophecies from the Old Testament? That's the predictions of, I guess, the Messiah to come. Have you researched that for yourself, sir? Go ahead.
He started off with prayer, so that's what I was addressing first.
Okay,
but
I apologize.
The research on the supernatural that occurred in the New Testament, is that what you're asking about? Is he aware that the New Testament at earliest was written in 65 Common Era? That is at least 32 years after Jesus' death. Most likely it was written in 70 or later, but I'll grant 65. There is no evidence from that time frame to back up any of these things. What is more reasonable? A man walked out of his grave as a zombie. You wouldn't believe that if somebody told you your dead friend Bob was down the street playing basketball. But if the Bible says so 32 years later, okay, great. That's got to be true. So these miracles that are supposedly occurring in the Bible are after the fact written, well after the fact written. It's far more likely that these were written to actually account for those instead of actually being from those.
Eric, that's your time. And what I want to do is I want to bring the caller 310 back online and ask him to very carefully and ask his question, make it a succinct question for Mr. Skelly. Thank you. Caller 310.
Yeah, I don't really have any questions for Kelly because I pretty much agree with everything he has to say. I have another question for Eric just to kind of flesh out what he was trying to prove to me. Can I present that question?
Hang on just a second. This, as we said during the show, we're not going to allow the callers to debate the speakers. I want to give Mr. Skelly an opportunity to address the question that you gave to Mr. Dickerson. So I'm going to do that now, and then we'll bring you back on, okay? Hang on. Mr. Skelly.
Yes, I understand the question, John. The question was, why doesn't Eric look into the positive claims of supernatural dealings in the Bible and even in modern day? Well, it's exactly what I said in my opening statement. He has a pre-commitment to atheist naturalism. It's not a matter of having enough evidence or not having enough evidence, like I said in my opening statement. It's a matter of his pre-commitment, and that's what I've been harping at all day. That his pre-commitment to atheistic naturalism can't even account for the things he uses to bring against the God of the Bible. Now, he is always going to look for it, unless he's willing to give up his atheistic naturalism, his worldview, his system. He is always going to look at the supernatural and try to find a naturalistic explanation for it, or try to dismiss it as being a fairy tale or force or false. That's what he does, and that's what he'll continue to do because of his commitment to atheistic naturalism. It has nothing to do with evidence. Like I said, I've seen in debates before where atheists will say, well, make this building levitate off the ground for several minutes, and then I'll believe a God exists. If the atheists saw that, they wouldn't believe God exists. It didn't work in the Bible. Jesus did miracles before. People fed the people with the loaves and the fish. And what did they do? They rejected him in John 6, even though he did that. Right, the Bible says the Jews seek for a sign, the Gentiles seek for wisdom, and the atheists do both. But they'll be given the gospel. And the gospel is foolishness to those who are perishing. And God has chosen the foolishness of the preaching to save those who will believe. So he won't submit to it because that's his pre-commitment. His worldview doesn't allow supernaturalism. Doesn't allow miracles. And so because his worldview doesn't allow those things, he has to look at them from an atheistic naturalistic point of view.
Thank you very much. Now, I'd like to go ahead and bring caller 570 back online and see, I think they had another question. Caller 570, did you have another question for our speakers, please?
Let me think.
Okay, well, go ahead and think on that for a moment.
Kerrigan, can I ask you again? Does God have the power and the ability to stop children from being raped? And if so, do you have a real explanation to why he doesn't, or are you just asserting that there's a good explanation and saying you don't know that Eric did again?
Say, can I ask you again?
Yes, because I'm asking, he asked you before. He asked you before, so I'm listening to the debate, and I'm hearing you say that, so I'm asking again, can you answer, does he not have the power to stop it, and does he not have the ability to stop it? And if so.
Okay, Kerrigan, go ahead. You got 2 minutes, please.
Yes, God does have the ability to stop it, and he could stop it if he chose to. And if it was God's perfect will were to happen every single time, there, like I said before, there'd be no rape, there'd be no sin, period. But for Eric or for his brother who's calling in, who's most likely helping him during the debate, that's what it sounds like anyway, if they want this to impute all evil that's ever been done to being God's fault simply because he didn't stop people from doing it, then the question I have for them is similar. Do you go around trying to stop all evil that you know about that you could stop? According to your own standard and worldview, then you're being immoral. And once again, what standard are you bringing against God, caller or Eric, to say that God is wrong for not stopping these things? In order to have a standard of morality, you must have a morality giver, an absolute standard giver. You don't have that, including your standard. In fact, your standard of morality, which is the survival of the fittest, has proven to be wrong because you won't even admit that if there's only one woman who refuses to have sex with men, refuses to reproduce with men, and that's the only way society would survive, that is it okay? Is it moral now, according to your standard of morality, survival is the most important thing, is it now moral for them to rape this woman? One atheist I heard was at least consistent with saying yes. So when it comes to God, God is infinite in wisdom. I don't presume to know why God allows every single thing he allows. I don't know that. The Bible doesn't give us those explanations. But I do know God is good and just, and the only way to have a system of morality or goodness or justice by which to judge anything or anyone, including God, would be the morality that God gives himself, because he's an absolute standard giver. And morality is an immaterial, abstract, universal, absolute thing which no atheist can account for, because their worldview is atheistic naturalism, and they can't account for abstract, immaterial things.
Okay, Eric, I'd like to bring you back on to comment about that, please.
Okay. This is ridiculous again, because I'm debating Kerrigan, who's living in a fantasy world of a false dichotomy where it's God or no explanation whatsoever for morality or inductive reasoning. There may be other explanations. There may be other God explanations other than his God. If we can't even debate in the realm where all possibilities are explored, that doesn't make for a fair debate in a real-world situation. He wants there to be two explanations. He wants to strawman my explanation of there's no that. I just don't know what the explanation is. He has yet to prove his explanation for it. And again, I say, I don't know is better than asserting. That is all he has done. Why can't he see that? All he's done is asserted because atheists don't know. Maybe, or my God must be right. Because atheists don't know an answer to a question. I ask him to please Google God of the Gaps argument. Please. This has been nothing but a red herring, God of the Gaps combo argument all day. He has yet to perform a logical statement on his burden of proof to say, from this, we get to this to get to God. All his premises have had God in it to beg the question as well. So it's basically, God of the Gaps is basically, to me, a begging the question argument, because you just simply hide the premise that begs that question. You hide your God in a hidden premise. So his arguments have failed because, I don't know, it could be moral fairies. Would I be more reasonable if I said it was moral fairies? No. I'd still have to demonstrate that. That's what I'm waiting for today.
Okay. I wanted to just take a moment for our listeners and remind them of our phone-in number is 914-338-1582, and would ask them to please formulate your question before you call in. Make it a succinct question and direct it to that particular speaker. Also, as a reminder to every speaker that's on the show, a straw man argument is an informal fallacy based on a misrepresentation of an opponent's position. To attack a straw man is to create the illusion of having refuted a proposition by substituting a superficially similar yet weaker proposition, the straw man, and then refuting it, without ever actually refuting the original position. Now, let me bring on caller 210, area code 210, caller, are you with us? Can you identify yourself, please?
Hi, my name is Jeremy. Just had a question for both of the speakers.
Hi, Jeremy. Please go ahead.
I heard in this debate that morality can be determined by what's best for society, and I would like to know who determines what is best for society and what standard do they use to determine that?
Okay, great question. I'm going to let Eric Dickerson begin with that answer. Please, Eric, go ahead. You have 2 minutes.
In general, morality can be determined by what's best for society. There may be special circumstances, like Kerrigan brought up, that it isn't. The general rule of thumb on that is, if you can do a study that shows that society survived better by doing this action, and that study can be done, we can know whether societies that avow rape survive better than societies that don't. If you just look at history, you could kind of look at societies that had more rape throughout their history and see which ones tend to survive better. And through that reasoning, you can figure out what's better for society. That is a general rule. It's not a golden rule of all situations, but it's something you can generally use to actually work with to try to determine what's best. Morality advances because we don't have all the answers. That's why at one point it was somewhat all right to own slaves, because they didn't think at the big picture of overall society. But eventually we learned that every society benefited more as a whole of society rather than as individual small societies, to work with that society rather than take them over as slaves. So that advancement occurred. That is a much better explanation for God, who ordered beating of slaves, is our source of morality. Because slave beating is not beneficial to society. I think anybody in this room or in this chat knows, basically, slave beating is wrong. We can all agree on that, whether we know the reason for it or not. I don't think there's anybody listening to this debate who doesn't know that. I would hope Mr. Skelly knows this, but I don't know, because he thinks beating slaves at one point was a perfect decision. That is what
time.
He must think.
Mr. Dickerson, time. Okay. I'm going to give Mr. Skelly an opportunity to answer that very good question. Please go ahead, Mr. Skelly.
It's a great question, Jeremy, and he really didn't answer it, to be honest. I really don't know where to start with all the fallacious things he said. He's said over and over again that he doesn't know for sure what is right and wrong, but these are just general rules. Well, where does he get these general rules from? Who says survival of the fittest is the most important? Even as a general rule, not in all circumstances. And if that doesn't apply, what applies in other circumstances? And like I said, who says that survival of the fittest is most important? Who says that's the most important thing to do? He said a minute ago, saying I don't know is better than asserting. Well, then you should be saying I don't know every single time. Instead of asserting anything, you should keep on saying I don't know. And that's just the point I'm making the whole time, is he doesn't know anything. Not only does he not know what the standard of morality is, if he's consistent with his atheism, he does not know that God is wrong for doing certain things or that anyone's wrong for doing anything. He couldn't possibly know that with any kind of absoluteness, any kind of surety, because he doesn't have an absolute standard of morality. It's the same question I've asked him all along, and he hasn't given an answer for it. He said, I don't know, many times throughout this debate. And once again, I've never said that it was God's perfect will for certain things to happen. I said God has allowed things to happen. He has a good reason for allowing things to happen. I have said I don't know why he allows things to happen, certain things to happen. But if God's perfect will was done, there'd never be rape. There'd never be lying. There'd never be stealing. There'd be any kind of sin. And Eric, once again, is trying to impute all the sin, all the evils ever happened in the world to God because he hasn't done anything about some of it. But is he doing everything he can about all this, all the crimes in the world that he knows about? Of course not. So according to his own standard, he's an immoral monster.
Okay, thank you very much, Kerrigan. I'm going to go back to Jeremy, who asked such a great question, and to see if he has a follow-on question. Jeremy, did you have a follow-on question?
Not really, but the reason I asked the question was, I have another question. I would say, how can we evaluate whose opinions on which moral standards are the best? For example, in Nazi Germany, the society there determined that the best action would be to eliminate certain races. Whereas the American culture determined that it was better if we didn't eliminate certain races, that we helped liberate them. So how could we determine between these two cultures to decide which one is right and wrong? They both may have performed studies and concluded on their own independent studies that they were right. So how can we independently of either of them decide which culture is right and what they did?
Okay, another good question there, Jeremy. Thank you very much. I want to go back to Eric, and speakers, if we could limit ourselves to 1 minute now. We're getting towards the end of the show. Let's try and limit ourselves to 1 minute to answers, if you would, please, Mr. Erickson, or Dickerson, sorry.
Okay. I would say that we can stop this red herring of where did morality come from. There's been no proof that morality came from God. So we can just say we don't know whether it comes from society or not. But one thing we can all agree on right now is that based on the evidence we have, it helps everyone survive if we don't have to worry about other countries eliminating races they don't particularly like. If you want to survive, it's probably in the best interest of everybody. And this is part of our I'm trying to think of the actual term, but part of what our instincts go towards survival. That's part of what has happened with evolution. And at the end of the day, if we survive, that's the best thing for us. So
time, Eric.
That was
okay. Thank you. Thank you. I want to limit this to 1 minute. Kerrigan, if you could, please.
Yeah. He's not going to convince someone who's suicidal that survival is the most important thing. He can't give a reason, an absolute standard of morality. He won't be able to because he has no absolute standard giver. Jeremy asked a good question about this morality with Nazi Germany. Hitler really believed, and people who are scholars on Hitler will say this, Hitler really believed he was doing what was right, that he was eliminating the Jews from society to benefit society and survive and create a utopian society. He really believed that. And I don't know why he believed, but he really did. If survival is the most important thing, should we commit euthanasia? Should we have abortions for people who aren't going to be good parents? Should we kill people who we know are going to be criminals in the future? These are the kind of problems you're going to have from an atheist worldview if you're going to say survival is the most important thing. God is the most important thing. And giving him glory and living for him and knowing him is the most important thing.
Thank you, Kerrigan. Now we have a caller from area code 919. Please identify yourself, please. It'll be the last question of the debate.
Yes, my name is Matthew, and I'm from North Carolina. And I had a question for Mr. Dickerson. I was wondering, based on, like, I'm not sure if you've researched a lot of it, but, like, the scientific consensus of the beginning of the universe, and where, in your opinion, did everything come from?
Okay, we're running out of time. Eric, go ahead and take a shot at it, buddy.
Beginning of the universe, we don't know. If you do a research into physics, all the Big Bang states is that we know up to milliseconds before the Big Bang. We don't even know what the Big Bang exactly was.
Okay, Eric,
so,
let me give a chance for Kerrigan to respond, please. Kerrigan, go ahead.
Okay.
Science is observed, reproduced, and tested. Atheists couldn't possibly know these things because they trust in science for everything, which they can't even trust in itself. They can't answer these tough questions. Either you have infinite regression or everything coming from nothing. Life coming from non-life, intelligence coming from non-intelligence. But I believe intelligence came from intelligence. God is the uncaused cause who began everything, and an atheist, of course, can't say that. So they're reduced to absurdity, and they even break their own scientific laws with their philosophies and theories about the beginning of the world.
Okay. Thank you so much. That concludes our show. This has been a great opportunity for debate and show, and I want to thank both of our speakers for joining me to communicate their respective positions. Join us next week for our grand finale of Refining Fire Radio. We hope that today's show has blessed you and strengthened you in the most holy faith in Jesus Christ. God bless and keep you as you seek to serve the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords.
If you love God, you obey Him. If you're not obeying Him, you don't love God. The question isn't whether God loves me. The question is whether you love God. If you love God, you obey Him. That's what Jesus said. Those are the words of my Savior.
You're going to be accountable for your actions.
Blood from you.